Okay, I want to thank everyone for coming. My name is Garrett Snedeker. I'm the Assistant Director of the James Wilson Institute. I have been working closely with Professor Arcus for about a year and a half now in shaping the direction of the Institute, and being able to put on events like these is an extra special pleasure because we're able to bring in friends new and old to be able to have the kind of substantive discussions that are lacking from the public discourse this day. So first, I'd just like to thank our friends at the Charles Koch Foundation, who've made this event possible with a grant, and thank our friends also from GW's Federal Society chapter, who were able to help us shape it as well. Finally, I'd like to invite everyone to stay afterwards for a reception for about an hour. So we're hopeful that many people can join us for that to digest the wonderful conversation, which I'm sure we're about to take in now. So, Professor Arcus.
Thanks, Garrett. I decided to just stand up for a moment because I'm losing my voice. Use the mic in the style of Lou Rukeyser to introduce the program and then rejoin Mike and our guests. We thought it would be a good thing to just bring together the friends and fans of Mike Carvin in the aftermath of the argument in King versus Burwell, you know, to savor again Mike's argument and to compare notes among ourselves, people who sort of watch the court closely, you know, close readers of the court. And Mike was generous enough to carve out the time to come, and we wanted you also to meet Yaakov. We'll have to meet another time Yaakov Roth, who worked with him. And of course, the administration has been holding out the prospect of doom befalling us if Obamacare is dealt a crippling blow here. And so one discussion naturally leads to the question of what may come afterward. And so this is a discussion of what the Republican Congress could possibly bring forth to deal with the crisis. And so we invited Yuval to come in. He and Jim Capretta have written quite a lot on what the dilemma is and what the Republicans might bring forth. And Justice Alito held out the interesting possibility that a stay could be granted to give Congress and the administration just time to work out those new arrangements. But a word about Mike Carvin. I first saw Mike in action about 20 years ago when I was called in implausibly as a consultant and expert witness in a case on gay rights in Cincinnati. And Mike had that case when he was at Shaw Pittman, right? Wasn't it? The case was a virtual replica of Romer versus Evans in Colorado. And when our side lost in Romer, I assumed we would lose as well in Cincinnati. But no, with Mike's skill, the Sixth Circuit sustained the victory we'd won in Cincinnati. Greg Katz has said that if Mike had been called by Norm Coleman when Norm Coleman was in the middle of a recount, that Norm Coleman would still be senator from Minnesota. And as Garrett points out, if that were the case, we wouldn't have had Obamacare. He would have been the 41st vote, and of course we might have not have needed Mike for NFIB or King versus Burwell. But as I said on our website, anyone who saw Mike in action that day and saw one of our premier appellate lawyers at the top of his form. I mean, they came at Mike from all angles. Mary Ellen Bork was there, Dr. Straub was there. They were from all angles, left and right, with Sotomayor and Kagan and so on. And without missing a beat, he was able to come back instantly with responses that were right on the mark. I mean, no one of us could imagine, any one of us could have possibly done that kind of a job if we were there. So what we saw was a lawyer quite deeply, thoroughly in command of the details and all the angles in the case. And I'm sure that even in the moot courts that were arranged, you probably didn't anticipate Elena Kagan's questions about her three clerks working on a draft. And yet, I thought Mike responded instantly with a better response than Sam Alito brought forth trying to help. But Mike was kind enough to say, that was my first response. No, Mike's response was even better. The line from the other side was that he should view the problem from the overall purpose of the scheme and not be so literal, not be so literal as to think that the phrase, an exchange established by a state, could not also encompass an exchange established by the federal government. But once we were there, the other side discovered at the oral argument a new concern for federalism. And if I read some of the lessons drawn from the arguments, then I gather that if I'd been able to offer Mike an honorarium of Clintonian proportions and then threatened to withhold it if he didn't come, I would have coerced him. Right. Well, of course, we want to talk about the question of federalism. But in opening the conversation, I just wanted to give it over to Mike. But those questions on the surface of the things. You know, we asked Mike to come in with his own sense of how it went that day. And of course, I follow up quickly with the question, did anything surprise you? Any surprises here? And was there something, anything that was missing? Anything you wished you'd said was somehow left out? But would you join me first in congratulating Mike on an argument so well done and welcoming him here.
So, how did the argument go? It went quite predictably, I think, in the sense that the four liberals were unrelievedly hostile. They didn't really surprise me at all. They were going through the standard checklist that the liberal media and the briefs by the government and their amicus had come forward with. I certainly appreciate Hadley's very kind remarks and what a skilled job it was, but I got to say, this is the easiest case I've ever had.
That was easy?
Well, I mean, in the Sixth Circuit, I had to convince them that an initiative that was identical to the one that had just been struck down in Romer v. Evans was nonetheless constitutional. And that takes some lawyering.
Yeah, that's right.
Convincing people that state means state is not what I call, you know, an intellectual challenge. And so in terms of, I thought we were way ahead on the briefs because our argument is very simple, compelling, consistent with the English language. flaws which the other side obviously embraces is, the one colloquy that I particularly enjoyed, because I've been dying to ask this question ever since this case started, was Justice Alito said to Verrilli, all right, you're an English-speaking person. You're trying to convey that subsidies are available on exchanges established by the federal government. Why do you write this language? What conceivable purpose would you have for saying exchanges established by the state? He began by saying, well, they tried to mean it was within the state. Justice Alito said, well, why didn't they say within the state? You know, there's a lot of language like that. And then Verrilli basically said, well, I guess they could have worded it differently. So the other point that, you know, again, straight out of the liberal talking points was we are trying to rip this language out of context. And Justice Kagan asked me that 3 minutes in, and I said, I implore you to look at the statute as a whole and put this in context, because wherever you look in the statute, it dramatically reinforces our argument. I won't repeat my answer, but the main point being obviously two, which is there's another provision in the statute that says states shall establish these exchanges, expressing in the strongest possible terms Congress's desire to have states establish exchanges, which cannot happen if you give them subsidies regardless of whether or not they establish their exchanges, as the IRS rule proves, because two-thirds of the states said no. The other point that they keep dwelling on, which is borderline bizarre, that the states didn't have notice because you put it in the tax code. And this is an extraordinarily rare place to put a tax credit. And I tried to make the point, no, if you're looking at tax credits, you generally look in the tax code. I also made the point that there's another limitation on when you get these subsidies. You must purchase it off an exchange, and then the immediately following words established by the state. Everyone seemed to figure out quite easily that this limitation on an exchange, that this was something that if you bought outside of an exchange, you didn't get the subsidies. So how were all of these detectives able to discern the word exchange that was hidden in the statute, but then stopped reading and not go beyond it? So there's really no argument that we were hiding an elephant in a mouse hole. I made the practical point that the state's had 3 years to figure this out. Right. And if the IRS hadn't done a bait and switch on them, there wouldn't have been any question in any state's minds about the stakes of either establishing an exchange or not establishing an exchange. I could go on with my eloquence and brilliance about the great arguments I gave. Justice Sotomayor served the invaluable role she always serves, which is ask obnoxious and not particularly enlightened questions, which enables you to expound on the obvious, at least in a way that is communicating to justices who have not completely made up their minds on the subject. In terms of the surprises, obviously the one that bothered me the most, or at least got me thinking the most, was Justice Kennedy's revival of this coercion argument, which, if you want to, by the way, pay any attention to my predictions about this case, let me tell you my predictions on the NFIB case. I said, I don't know what's going to happen, but I can tell you two things. They're never going to call the individual mandate a tax, and they're never going to say that these Medicaid conditions are coercive and unconstitutional. So my Nostradamus bona fides intact, I will say I really think that the liberal media and the liberal professors are probably misunderstanding the end result of Kennedy's argument. Without getting too deep into the weeds, his point is, look, this is unduly coercive because it puts too much pressure on the state. Don't really understand that argument, but 3 points. One, NFIB just upheld a version of Medicaid which puts much greater pressure on the states, both in terms of volume of dollars and creates the same kind of dislocation in the healthcare market that Kennedy was worried about. Every hospital came in and said, look, if the states turn down the Medicaid deal, as you've now revived it in NFIB, we're going to go bankrupt because part of the quid pro quo in the Affordable Care Act was we get less money for serving poor populations, and that was supposed to be made up for by all this additional Medicaid money. Even the Washington Post reported last week, however, that in the 22 states that turned down the medical deal, hospitals are doing just fine. The economic point is they tend to exaggerate the consequences of these things. And, of course, just in terms of the practical ability to say no, we do have 8 states as amicus in this case saying we will say no. We don't like this exchange deal. And part of the reason for that is because along with the subsidies comes the employer mandate. Does everybody know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
The employer mandate is only triggered if one of your employees gets subsidies. And these states were making the point that, look, the real intrusion on federalism here, on state sovereignty here, would be if the federal government could unilaterally impose on state governments in particular the requirement that they pay for their health insurance for their employees. And that's one of the points I tried to make to Justice Kennedy in rebuttal was, if you're trying to figure out the principle is called constitutional avoidance. It clearly says state, but let's see if we can interpret it in a different way, because if we interpret it in a different way, I will avoid this difficult constitutional question. Well, the different way to interpret it would be to say that subsidies are available in all states, even on HHS exchanges. And 3 points there. One, as Justice Scalia immediately noted, there's no way that there's ambiguity in the word state that it can be somehow magically converted into federal. And Justice Kennedy, at 3 different points in the argument, seemed to agree with that, that there was no ambiguity at all. So the constitutional avoidance doctrine doesn't get any traction in the first instance. The second point, which is the one I just alluded to, is that if you adopt the government's view, you're not avoiding a constitutional question, you're just creating another constitutional question, i.e., can the federal government unilaterally impose this employer mandate on the state? But the third, and I'm thinking the one that may resonate the most with Justice Kennedy, is as follows. He says, look, the constitutional avoidance question would mean that I would give subsidies in all 50 states even if they didn't create exchanges. I would expend money from the federal treasury though I don't think that Congress intended me to spend that money. I think the better reading of the statute is they only intended me to spend these subsidies, these billions of subsidies, where states had created the exchanges, but I'm now unilaterally expanding that to all 50 states. That's not only contrary to basic separation of powers principles, it's contrary to the basic point that Justice Kennedy himself raised in the argument, which is because of Congress's power of the purse, we will only infer that subsidies can come out of the federal treasury if Congress has spoken to the question unambiguously. So the point would be that in an effort to feed his federalism concerns, he would have to violate his separation of powers concerns, where he has written in a couple of opinions saying that you can't draw money from the federal treasury unless Congress has authorized it. So you're just creating a different kind of constitutional dilemma. The final point, which was way too nuanced to make in the argument, and one that I felt, frankly, would alienate other key votes like Chief Justice Roberts, is as follows. In NFIB, the dissenting opinion said, look, you just determined, you, Chief Justice Roberts, just determined that the Medicaid condition was partially unconstitutional, to make it clear. You put on the table the old Medicaid funding, and that was unduly coercive. You have then said, I'm nonetheless going to eliminate that condition, but do the subsidies. No, the NFIB dissent said, the right thing to do is to eliminate the subsidies. In other words, if you think that it's unduly coercive to offer the states a lot of money in terms of these subsidies for these exchanges, the solution is not to give them the subsidies that Congress never authorized, it's to cut off all subsidies for all 50 states. And that would have had very draconian consequences in the NFIB context, but nonetheless, the dissent endorsed this theory for reasons similar to what I just articulated. How is it that the judiciary can authorize appropriations in circumstances where Congress didn't? So, Justice Kennedy, if you actually struck down this law as unconstitutional, what you would say is, therefore, there are subsidies in zero states, no states. It would be a bizarre principle of constitutional avoidance to say, I'm avoiding that and giving you subsidies in 50 states. The remedy for the constitutional avoidance is precisely the opposite of striking the law down as unconstitutional. The procedural points I'll quickly make, and I got them out during argument, was this has not been briefed or argued. None of the states that supposedly are injured are litigants here, so you really shouldn't make new law, particularly one that de facto overrules NFIB, without this kind of briefing. So, if you tally all those together, my prediction is Justice Kennedy joins the four other justices on the statutory point and says, as he's done in a number of cases, including with Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, I am signing on to the statutory construction issue. There's a very serious constitutional question. But for all these complicated reasons that I just touched on, it wouldn't make sense for me to do it now. But if the states who are being victimized by this scheme come to me, then they've, you know, I will listen to their constitutional concern. But it's just a concurring opinion after he's joined the five justices. And again, to maybe belabor what I just said, if he goes off on his own tube and says this is unconstitutional, it'll be four votes for striking down the subsidies under statutory grounds in 34 states. If he follows what he says in NFIB, there'll be one vote for striking down subsidies in all 50 states, and then the four dissenting opinions. So what Justice Kennedy was doing, I think, was putting on the table a much more draconian revision of the Affordable Care Act than our statutory argument would lead to. And I think he was quite conscious of the fact that he really couldn't use the constitutional avoidance theory to rewrite the statute. So what he was really asking us and Solicitor General Verrilli was, can I strike down the statute in these circumstances? So at the end of the day, I feel relatively optimistic. The other part of the argument that I think has gotten a lot of media attention is Chief Justice Roberts didn't speak a whole lot. To me, look, maybe it's just my prior experience in predicting so badly, but this to me is like those Kremlinologists, you know, who are like, do you notice Gorbachev was looking to the left? And, you know, do you notice, you know, Chief Justice Roberts wasn't smiling? I think he probably just didn't want to show his hand one way or the other. I think the limited comments that he made were generally supportive of us. And I think the key point that came out between Kennedy and Roberts was, excuse me, I always thought the way we'd most easily lose is the way we lost in the Fourth Circuit, which was, it's a complicated statute. Look at it in context. Gee, right. Ambiguity. Defer to the IRS under Chevron. But Kennedy clearly was not going there. He's like, look, we didn't delegate to the IRS this extraordinary important question of billions of dollars in individual mandate. Right. Indeed, if you buy the government's argument, they delegated to the IRS this question, should we destroy the Affordable Care Act? Because under their theory, if you don't have subsidies, then the entire act blows up and millions of people die, and we gave GS-14s at the IRS the ability to make this decision. It just does not compute. So even if there's ambiguity, he's not going to delegate to the IRS. He can't delegate on ambiguity because of this canon that you interpret tax credits very narrowly. And then I think this is where Chief Justice Roberts was going. He asked Verrilli, he's like, under your theory, when Senator Ted Cruz is elected in 2016, he can instruct his IRS not to have these subsidies. He didn't mention Ted Cruz, but he said the next administration could simply say no, which I think illustrates sort of the intellectual paucity of the notion that we have delegated this fundamental policy issue, particularly that involving federal funds out of the Treasury, to the IRS, particularly since the next president can make the whole scheme unwind, according to Solicitor General Verrilli's lights, and nobody can really argue that that's the kind of thing that a bureaucrat is empowered to do under an important statute. So the silver lining in all of this conversation with Kennedy and Roberts, I think, is that there's not going to be a lot of temptation to take what I'd call the coward's way out, which is say, gee, this is all ambiguous and there's a lot of anomalies and we can't figure it out, so we'll just let the IRS do it. So I don't think they're going to go that way. If they don't go that way, I remain unflaggingly optimistic for the reasons I started with, which is there's just not an intellectually coherent way to say state means federal. Nothing that the liberals came up with added anything to it. To the extent they gave me an opportunity to respond, I think I refuted all their arguments, not only in the brief, but in argument. And I think that, and the other minor point is, they were cutting me off quite quickly when I was trying to make answers. And Chief Justice Roberts, in a very unprecedented kind of thing, just gratuitously said, take 10 more minutes, because he wanted me to have the ability to get out my answers. So net-net, as I say, with the caveat that I completely got my predictions in NFIB 100% wrong, we are so far ahead on the law, I still retain the naive belief that five of them are sufficiently dedicated to the rule of law that we should prevail in the face of what are undisguised, transparent policy arguments on the other side. It would be extraordinarily difficult for somebody of Chief Justice Roberts' intellect to sign the kind of nonsense that will be the dissenting opinion.
Let me draw you off at one point. Then I want to turn over and bring in my buddy Ed Whalen from EPPC and Kerry Severino, who's been writing on benchmarks. In fact, we have three Severinos with us today, right? Roger, Kerry, and Nicholas in utero. Right. Okay. That line of Verrilli's was elicited by Roberts in one of his rare interventions. Now, I read it to one guy close to Roberts who said, he might have been telling us there's a political solution to this problem and we could have constitutional avoidance. That struck me as quite implausible, and I was wondering what your reading of it was.
Yeah.
Because on one hand, there's a conjecture about what, because he must know that if this remains, it'd be very hard for any subsequent administration to undo it.
Yeah, right.
He must know that.
And if he's going to go with deference to the political process, then the short way to write it, fully consistent with his opinion in NFIB, which I think he will write, is, I told you in NFIB I'm deferring to the policy questions and the political processes. That's for the people across the street, not for the judiciary. If they don't like this principle, and if it's sufficiently draconian, as the dissent says, then I have to reasonably assume that the people who are elected by these people are being hurt will fix it, either at the state or federal level.
Right.
So it flows like butter. He says, I'm doing exactly what I did when they asked me to overturn the ACA as the law of the land. I said no. Now I'm implementing the ACA as the law of the land.
Right.
And if Congress wants a different policy, that's why we have elections. Go
right.
to it.
I'm just calling it balls and strikes.
Yes. No, it's perfectly consistent with, look, we all know that if this issue was some kind of mortgage deduction, I would have won 9-0, and everybody would have been like, what do you mean state means federal? So he knows intuitively that he will be perceived as doing politics and not staying out of politics if he says state means state. That said,
the left has
mounted an enormous campaign saying if you interpret state to mean state, you're somehow being political. I'd be interested in Ed's view. My own view is that John took a sufficiently severe beating after the unfortunate occurrence in NFIB that he does not want to be perceived. I mean, he's a very talented, smart justice as somebody who gives in to this kind of unalloyed liberal pressure in the media. And I don't think there's any way to interpret what we've been seeing for the last 3 months as sort of a naked effort to tell Roberts, you sign off on these policy consequences and we're going to come after you. I don't think, A, he believes it. I think he understands intuitively that the way for the court to appear as a non-political player is to follow the statute as written. And I think if I was him, I would be quite insulted by the notion that these people think they can intimidate me to to change my vote because the New York Times is going to write a nasty editorial. When John took the job, he knew if he followed the law, he was going to get a nasty editorial in the New York Times. The notion that he's now just waking up to this and will be intimidated by it strikes me as A, unrealistic, and B, potentially counterproductive.
I read it in rather the same way, so I'm sort of upbeat about this. But I detected in Ed's eye the look of dubiety about the upbeat thing. And it could be when the situation, what Mike Novak describes as the Polish optimist and the pessimist.
Yeah.
Where the pessimist says, things can't get any worse. And the optimist says, oh, yes, they can.
No, Ed Whalen, he's always been my Eeyore.
Come on.
He's always been my half empty guy. So give me the contrary and doomsday view.
Well, I do like to say that an incidental advantage of being a pessimist is that I'm usually right. I also don't think my predictive record for the Supreme Court has been very good. So, but look, anytime I hear Justice Kennedy and rule of law in the same sentence, and counting on Justice Kennedy to stand up for the rule of law, okay, that scares me. You know, he hasn't done that in 20 plus years. He does it, you know, sporadically, but it's certainly something.
And I apologize for interrupting you so early, but no, to continue on that theme, I have two interesting questions. I'd very much like your view on them. Number one, I'm not counting on him from the rule of law. I'm counting on his unbridled hatred of the ACA to carry me across the goal line. But then I'd like your ideas. Let me say, as optimistic as I am about the ACA case, I'm probably as pessimistic as Ed is about our chances of us prevailing in the gay marriage case.
Yeah.
So the other point, which of course is completely non-legal and non-judicial, is they have done it in the past where at the end of the term they gave one to the liberals and one to the conservatives. And so I'd like you to factor that in and give me your views on that.
Well, psychologizing about Justice Kennedy is probably one of my favorite things to do. But there is this perception that he is somehow inclined to, you know, give one this way and one that way. And again, it's difficult to be hopeful. I mean, Justice Ginsburg has to say she's telegraphed what she thinks the result would be would understate it, you know. No, I think that's a factor that might help. Let me just mention one minor legal point that one of my colleagues wasn't clear on, and I think, you know, bolsters your case, which is the term state is itself a defined term. That is, no one thinks that state might mean government. State is defined to mean the states or D.C., I think, right?
Right.
So again, there's no way you can read that term as what Verrilli said. It's a term of art. But on the chief, I'm also, concerned. I'm concerned in part because he has shown a very idiosyncratic approach to statutory interpretation. I think this last year in the Bond case, he found ambiguity. It's a treaty case, and that's Scalia in the sense that how can you call this ambiguous? So there's this notion that the left is pushing that if they come up with a statute that's messy enough, it can be deemed ambiguous, and therefore the bureaucrats can do whatever they want. I don't think I don't think that makes sense, but I'm worried that the chief might be inclined towards that approach. And you also have to worry.
Well, let me cut push on that a little bit.
Yeah.
He also has not shown, unlike Scalia, for example, a marked distrust of giving administrative agencies too much power.
Right.
So while I concede what you just said,
right. That
would be a countervailing influence, and that's why I read a lot into his Chevron question at the article.
Which was his only question.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
His only, I mean, apart from saying you lost that previous
case,
I mean, there's nothing that he said, which concerns me, because if, like, I have a lot of respect for the chief, but if you think that he might be intimidated, what would someone who's intimidated do? Might be very, very quiet during oral argument in order not to show his hands, in order not to feel a lot of pressure over the coming months. So, just statistically, if you put it at, you know, 50-50, you need both Kennedy and the chief. If you put each at 50-50, combine them, you have a 1/4 chance of winning. And that's probably where I would, you know, put the betting line at this point. But I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, by the way, this is all, as I say, Kremlinologist dancing on the head of a pin. And I gave it up a long time ago, even though people keep asking me the question, because it's a fool's errand. And we'll all find out on June 29th. And I won't go into it, but
no,
Clarence Thomas has a thing where he asks his clerks, when he comes back from conference, how do you think the votes lined up? These clerks have been there, they've seen the justices, they've seen the argument, and he tells me they're wrong at least 30% of the time. So you can imagine our track record.
And Clarence is usually right.
And well, he's always right. He's not always victorious.
That's right. He's right at predicting. He's good at predicting. He's really good at predicting. Okay, but Kerry, you were there. Have any reflections yourself?
I can say that when I was looking for Justice Thomas, our stats were at least that low. So with that caveat, I have to say I started out after oral arguments a little more in Ed's camp, and I've moved slightly more toward a note of optimism, I think largely based on pondering the actual consequences of what Kennedy's theory of coercion would entail, not just for this law, but just for any kind of spending legislation out there. If just dollar amounts can account to coercion, amount to coercion, and make it unconstitutional, it's in the open season on any law out there.
Right,
it's really hard to imagine how even Justice Kennedy, who I have to say I don't give him a lot of points for confidence in his consistent, logical thinking across different areas of law, but you've got to realize it's going to endanger so many major pieces of legislation that I find it hard to believe he could quite be sloppy enough to embrace that theory, especially when I think he might be the only vote in the court to say that there actually is a constitutional issue. So to say we're going to avoid this serious constitutional issue that I don't think you can possibly have 5 votes for the fact that there's a real constitutional issue there. It seems a little bit strange. I was also struck by how much farther the government was going than I even expected they would in terms of trying to say state means federal. The one that struck me as the strangest was when he said, because they said shall, and we know they can't force the states to do things, they must have meant state means federal there too. And you're like,
I had a little trouble computing that argument.
And then toward the end, there was another exchange where he talked about, oh no, but they said the state shall do that. And I was like, no, apparently they meant they don't. When shall doesn't mean shall, and state doesn't mean state, then all bets are off.
And Kennedy was given pushback on that line of argument. Yeah.
So I think they have to go so far out there that it's going to be challenging. The only thing that the biggest thing that concerns me is just watching the media push and really feeling like that did such a number on Justice Roberts last time, Chief Justice Roberts last time. I hope he's been chastened by the response, but I don't know. Inside sources in the court tell me half his clerks are pretty out there on the left, and three quarters of Kennedy's clerks are. So that doesn't make me feel any more confident. I hope they have a little bit of ability to think independently of that, but that's its own factor that doesn't help our side. But I don't know. So I think I'm still.
I will make one little point about Chief Justice Roberts in terms of the political consequences. Scalia made the obvious point. Well, if they're bad things, then Congress can fix it.
Yeah.
The Solicitor General said this Congress and evoked laughter. I thought that was clearly the low point of Verrilli's thing. I think the notion that we're going to defer to Congress when we like the composition is very disrespectful. And again, I'm sure I'm reading it. I saw John visibly blanch at that, like this notion that I'm going to come out to a difficult. I don't even fall off his chair, but he was like, "Don't go there." And stipulate to everything you just said. It's still an easy opinion to write. That look, if we got it wrong. These are issues for the political branches, right. As I emphasized in NFIB. Right.
That said, just dealing with the media a lot, it's going to be, assuming they get it right, it's going to be kind of like a Citizens United level. I can't believe this court is so political. Every single, the talking points are so settled. Anyone who reads past the end of this sentence knows the context. It's so clear that's not what they meant.
Read the brief.
They're like, gosh, exactly. It's all about whether you read in context or not. That's just, their talking point, boiling it down. That's absurd. It's a straw man, but that's what they set up. And I was on a radio show the other day where the line was, and if they pass it, there will be wives who will never kiss their husbands again, and mothers who will never kiss their children again. And I'm like, seriously, can you ramp up the drama a couple more notches?
No, well, remember, these...
There'll be people in wheelchairs trying to... I mean, it's going to be a serious...
Well, you remember what America was like 15 months ago before we had these subsidies. You couldn't walk down K Street without chemo victims crawling up. It was just people... There was not any... I mean, they would think that this thing had been like, you know, Social Security. It's been in operation for 15 months.
Dana Milbank out Milbank himself. He predicted a national conflagration.
I stipulate to that point, but that's headline on Tuesday. On Wednesday, it's gays can marry, right?
In terms of the media backlash, that might actually, the fact they're coming down the same day.
That's the one issue that... I'm praying for.
Be a much bigger thing.
Right, we'll be on A4 of the Post. You know. Right. Like, oh, by the way, you know.
I like that moment when Kagan said, "I couldn't find this thing. I had to go into this Texas," and Sam said, "If you were an officer of the state trying to figure out what you'd have to pay, where would you look?" Yes, I look at that too.
That is their silliest argument. And believe me, that's climbing a high bar. They didn't notice it. They had 3 years to figure this out, and nobody read the substance section? I mean, really? Because we had hidden it there? I mean,
I want to turn to Yuval, because he and Jim Capretta have been writing a recent piece in the Weekly Standard. Actually fed my pessimism if we win, because it looks as though you had some good ideas, but there's a prospect that Obama could just about block anything our people put forth. Why don't you give your own sense of it?
Well, first of all, I thought the most ironic thing coming out of the oral argument was the notion that it was on the matter of federalism that the government might win. If there's a simple offhand way to define federalism, it is that established by the state and established by the federal government are not the same thing. That's roughly how you would define that word, and somehow things have turned around so much in our Alice in Wonderland that it seems to mean exactly the opposite. I don't know how to read the court, but my job is even more depressing because it is to read the Congress. And, I think that when Republican members of Congress look at this case, they see risk and they see opportunity. And the trouble is, I used to work once for the House Budget Committee, and my boss there would say, to know how people are going to vote, just follow the fear. And this does look like an instance where follow the fear for the moment tells us more than follow the hope. I think members look at this as a risk more than an opportunity. And there are those among us who have been trying for months now to suggest to them that that's not the case. Maybe we've made a little progress and maybe we haven't. I think that the doom and gloom has gotten to them some too. And the notion that the day after a decision for the plaintiffs, they're going to get a call from their Republican governor and their Republican state saying, please save Obamacare, is high on their minds. I think it's a little crazy. It seems to me that the possibility exists that there would be a lot of pressure for action and that Congress would need to act. I don't think it's as ridiculous as the Solicitor General thinks that Congress would act.
Sure.
And I think that there will be some work done in advance to be ready to take actions of different kinds in different circumstances. It seems to me the important thing would be, first of all, to see what the reaction really is. You know, we'll be looking at a situation where roughly 6 million or so people would lose subsidies after a time. About 8 million people would no longer be subject to the individual mandate after having been subject to it. About 250,000 employers would no longer be subject to the employer mandate in these states, covering more than 50 million workers. There are different sides to this, and the question at that point is, where does the individual market go in these states? And that's not a question that's going to be answered the day after the decision. Even if there's not a state, let alone if there is, the idea that there will be some immediate meltdown doesn't strike me as very plausible. I do think Congress needs to be ready, not only because there may be pressure on them after a time, but also because this is an opportunity. The fact is that these states will find themselves in a place where they can go to Congress and ask for an alternative to the kinds of regulatory system that they have been under for the last 15 months and that isn't working for many of them. And Congress could be in a position to offer them some alternative. A lot of what has been talked about as steps Congress might take involve this idea of an alternative. Again, it is about federalism, properly understood, which is to say that a decision for the plaintiffs could lead to a situation where Congress can offer these states an alternative regulatory scheme, where the people who have lost subsidies would regain access, possibly, to some federal funding stream at the same time that the states gain control of their own individual markets, that the states are allowed to opt out of the Obamacare regulatory scheme and into a situation where there are very few federal rules and where the states, again, are in charge of regulating health insurance. And again, it's not an unimaginable situation. The states did this for 70 years until last year. It's fairly easy to imagine how they'd go about it. The laws are all still on the books. One option before Congress, therefore, is to allow the states an opt-out, an off-ramp from Obamacare, to allow them to choose to opt out of the Title I regulations in Obamacare, all the rules that define the insurance product, all the rules that require them to only make certain kinds of coverage available in their state, and essentially retake control of their individual market, and they would get some kind of funding stream that would let them subsidize up to a point, a smaller level, a lower level of subsidies, to create a transition for people who had been receiving subsidies and now wouldn't be. Some people talk about this in terms of a direct tax credit to individuals. Some people talk about it in terms of a block grant to the state that, on the model of some other federal programs, like SCHIP for children, lets the state create a system that as it sees fit, allows people to have easier access to coverage. A couple of these types of approaches have been proposed, one of them by the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee and the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, which are the two committees that control healthcare in the House of Representatives. That could certainly be on the table. That's being written up as a bill and will certainly be one by the time that a decision comes down. There are other proposals. Senator Ben Sasse in the Senate has proposed a kind of narrower response that uses a different funding stream, not recreating the Obamacare subsidies so that you don't reawaken the mandates, to provide people with a temporary, time-limited replacement for the subsidy at a lower level that, again, transitions them out of Obamacare and, in the meantime, allows their state to create for itself a different regulatory scheme or to return to its prior regulatory scheme. What unites these ideas is that they would take a victory for the plaintiffs in this case as an opportunity to show the country what a conservative approach to healthcare policy would look like alongside the states that are following what a liberal approach looks like, on the premise that the contrast would look pretty good for the conservative approach and that it would strengthen the case for a full repeal of the law and its replacement by some more conservative approach to this, more market-oriented, consumer-oriented approach to healthcare financing after the 2017 election. Would force the Republican nominee to be in favor of a move in a market-oriented direction, and would show the public what that looks like in actual states with actual people, where people are not pushing their grandparents off cliffs, but instead have a more functional, not a less functional, health insurance market. It's a way to think about the case as an opportunity and not just a risk. Yeah?
I have a question for you. Let me, play pessimist again here, but wouldn't there be some sort of game of chicken going on between Republicans on the Hill and President Obama, assisted by Senate Democrats during the filibuster, where President Obama would simply say, the solution to this is for Republican governors to set up exchanges. We'll help them do that. Here's the prototype. We can have this done in a matter of days. Nice, simple solution. I'm not going to sign anything that involves an attack on Obamacare. And again, part of the gimmick may be the Senate Democrats, would use the filibuster to make sure nothing even got to his desk to float the on him. So
absolutely. I think that does assume a kind of doom and gloom scenario that happens almost immediately and creates enormous pressure that he can use to drive Republicans. It's possible. I think that, in a sense, Republicans would face the same problem they've faced with this president since they took over the House, and have certainly seen this year, having taken over the Senate, too, that they have very little leverage over him because he doesn't really want anything from them. The president doesn't actually have a governing agenda after his first 2 years, and it doesn't really bother him if everything falls apart because you create a crisis and he's the calm man in the crisis, and he's confirming all the worst things people think about Republicans and standing there kind of tut-tutting and saying, when are these people going to grow up? You know, this Congress, as his Solicitor General told the justices, that's what happened in the DHS fight. That's what happens in budget fights. There's nothing the president wants from Congress, and so it's very hard to exercise much leverage over him in a situation where nothing is the default.
But that's
he thinks
why
he wins every one of those.
But that's why this is different, right? Because this is he could play hockey goalie for the next 3 years, batting everything back. He can't let this wither away on the vine.
Right. This is his legacy.
Ed, the talking point would be, we've just heard all these horror stories about people who need this federal money to get adequate health care. We have put something on his desk or proposed it to Senate Democrats which does that. Obama is saying, no, you don't get that much needed money unless you do it my way, through a government-controlled, one-size-fits-all exchange.
That kind of reaction,
if we can't win that debate, then it doesn't matter because we're never going to win the presidency.
The opportunity Republicans would have would make itself apparent if they played the role that he usually plays, which is to say, either Obamacare falls apart or you do what we say. We're fine either way. It's not the case that millions of people are going to die if this happens, or any people. After all, we lived without this law for American history until last year. And if you want your legacy to be saved, here's a way, which will change things but avoid pandemonium. I don't know if Republicans can hold together in a way that lets them say that, but I think this situation creates the opportunity for that that they haven't really had before. It would require them not to believe that pandemonium hurts them ultimately. Now, there's a danger here, and the danger is some Republican governors could fold under the pressure they would face from people in their state who lose subsidies, from the hospitals that have shown themselves very capable of applying pressure on them, and could effectively entrench Obamacare by choosing to create a state exchange. I think we've overestimated how fast things would happen in the wake of a decision for the plaintiffs here. The politics would not work themselves out in the next day's newspaper, and it would take some patience, and it would take Republicans saying, we have an alternative, or several, that we're willing to vote on right now, that we're willing to send to you right now. Democrats wrote this law by themselves. A Democratic administration put it into effect. It turns out the law was written carelessly and put into effect lawlessly. And how exactly is this Republicans' fault? I think that's not a hard argument to make, but that's not to say that it's going to be easy for a lot of Republican members of Congress to make.
But a few follow-up points on that. In terms of the Republican governor's political calculus, first of all, if the Republicans can come together behind a proposal and Obama does play the game you anticipate it, they'll certainly say, look, there's a proposal out there which would negate the need for me to create this exchange. Obama caused this problem. I'm not going to spend good money after bad, jump into the exchange game before I even realize what it's going to accomplish. Number two is your timing point, I think, is essential. If there's any kind of effort or quid pro, you know, kind of back and forth between the administration, this is not going to get resolved to the end of 2015. We'll have just started the new 2016, and we'll be in the middle of a presidential election. Right. Then it's very easy for a Republican governor to say, no, I support whoever, you know, Marco Rubio's plan to do this, not President Obama's. And then Republicans are like, am I really going to abandon the Republican view that's a key presidential talking point in the middle of a presidential election year? All we're trying to do is give them enough time not to act precipitously. And the final factor in all that, of course, is the employer mandate, which is if they do go along with this exchange alternative, they're not just getting subsidies to people, they're dragging a whole bunch of their employers into the state.
Plus individual mandate.
Well, for some people.
It'll dramatically increase the number of individual mandates, but there will literally be no employer mandate.
Yeah.
So there'll be strong counter pressure.
I think there's also one more pressure they're going to face, which is like what the governors might face from the hospitals, and that's the pressure on the administration from the insurers, who are not going to want to go into the 2016 insurance year uncertain about what's going to happen. And they're going to demand to be given the option of having two contracts, or they'll just say that they're not going to go into these states. That is, in a lot of ways, a greater threat to the president's Obamacare legacy than the pandemonium that would happen. If the insurers say, we can't factor the risk here and we're just not going to play, for a lot of the larger national insurers, the exchanges are a very small part of their business. It's not worth it to them to take huge risks just to stay in them.
No,
and you could end up in a place where the administration is facing insurers bolting on them if they don't take some action. And then again, Republicans could find themselves with leverage.
Let me ask,
very hard to say.
It also seems helpful that you have these eight states that have stated quite clearly that they will not set up exchanges. Can we count on them to?
Oh yeah, look.
I
think they've figured out which side their bread is buttered on. Number one, number two. I won't repeat all the points I made. I think it'll be easier for Republicans. Remember, these legislatures aren't even in session, right? The logistics of trying to get an exchange up and operational for the employment period that's going to affect. You'd have to basically have the whole deal operational by November 1st at the latest, right? So the inertia here is huge. And then, again, I just think, you said it right before, it's going to be a high-stakes game of chicken. This is the first time we played a high-stakes game of chicken with Obama, where if we walk away from the bargaining table, his signature achievement goes down the tubes, and we have perfectly plausible reasons to do it. So why would a Republican governor in that political atmosphere say, no, I'm going to jump in and get on Obama's side? And I think the pressure from the insurers will be monumental. I'm hardly a healthcare expert. My understanding is they're not in love with these exchanges. They're going into it because they much prefer the old individual market, but they're going in, they think it's a market, they think they can have some loss leaders under this, I won't get into it, this risk insurance quarter, take their lumps, but sign up a captive audience, you know, for 5 or 6 years down the road. If you tell them they're going to have this chaotic ride for the next 2 or 3 years, again, I'm hardly an expert, but insurance actuarials are not what you call shoot from the hip type of guys. If they can't tell their board, no, we're going to get this return on this amount of money, they are very risk averse, and I think they'll stay out. I think that'll create enormous pressure on Obama to say we need some kind of relief. But I am never underestimating our ability to screw up an easy win or our ability to have our coalition fray. I will say again, this is the one instance where if our coalition does splinter apart, that's de facto us walking away from the table, which means there won't be any of these quick fixes. And hopefully it'll happen late enough in the game that the Republican governors can say, this is all going to be decided by the next presidential election. I'm not throwing good money after bad. I can't get this operational now. And Obama's got to pay the price for his lawlessness.
Yeah. I think there are so many alternative paths to the prospect of Republicans saving Obamacare that it's almost unimaginable that that's what they end up doing, that they extend these subsidies, bring back the mandates. The kind of work that I and others have been doing is an attempt in part to show them that there's a range of options here. Some of them are very aggressive and could really point the way toward an alternative to Obamacare in 2017 with a new president. Some of them are much less aggressive and just say, we don't extend these, we punt till after the election. Even if that's what you do, you're basically creating a situation where 2016 becomes an Obamacare election, uh-huh. where the candidate, the Republican nominee, has to have something to say about this.
Right.
And even that is some progress.
Sure.
It's not impossible that they commit the degree of malpractice that it would take to just save Obama from himself here. But I do think it's unlikely. They will have a lot of other options, and if they can keep their head about them, they can take one of those options. Now, look, Republicans have not found it easy to unite around anything. An aggressive, ambitious approach that would require a unified Republican conference probably isn't what's going to happen. I think it could still make sense as the place to start and to show that they're offering the states something, have the states ask for it, find it attractive, show the public that Republicans have more to say. Is that where they end up? I think they end up with something much more modest than that, with something much more like what SAS is proposing, or even more modest than that. But even so, where they cannot end up, is in a place that brings back these kind of subsidies in some permanent way. At the very least, they have to keep Obamacare an open question through the 2016 election. And I do think that there are enough ways for them to achieve that it can happen. And to their credit, they are preparing. A group of senators meets every week about this. You've got the key chairman in the House trying to work on options here months in advance of where they'll need to be. I do think they're trying to not get this one too wrong. And maybe I'm too optimistic, but I think they'll manage to do that.
Yuval, I want to be clear on this. I thought our people favored, say, the freedom to buy policies across state lines.
Well, look, Obamacare's changed things, right? So the core of Obamacare, as far as I'm concerned, from a kind of health economics point of view, is that it takes over the core regulation of health insurance. It defines the product. It says this is what health insurance is, and then it forces providers of insurance to sell that product, and it forces consumers to buy that product. And then just to insult us, it calls that
a marketplace.
People are buying and selling, right? And so as long as that's the case, as long as Title I of Obamacare is in place and they get to define what health insurance is, allowing people to buy it across state lines doesn't help us, because all we're saying is you can now buy Obamacare-approved products across state lines. That doesn't change the basic situation.
But to be clear,
buying across state lines makes a difference if the states are regulating insurance. So if there's a difference between what it can mean in one state and another. If you do that, if you give regulation back to the states, then the kind of familiar traditional Republican healthcare ideas all make sense again. If you don't do that, then there's almost nothing we can do. That's why any conservative reform of the health insurance system requires a repeal of Obamacare. And there's really no way to get where we're going without repealing Obamacare, because by taking over the definition of health insurance, they make it impossible for Republicans to do anything that they would want to do to move toward a market system.
But that's why what I don't view it as a very radical point, right, which is to frame it to the public. We're going to get you roughly the same amount of federal assistance, but we're going to do it in a way that empowers you to make your choices. You can buy catastrophic health insurance if you're 30 years old. And don't want to buy, you don't need mental health, you don't need maternity leave, and it would be a very effective argument, and you don't have to go to these exchanges, which work so brilliantly, and wait for 18 days to figure out what your options are. So my pitch to the conservatives in the House and Senate has been, this is not a way to cave or to mimic Obamacare. It's a very effective way, easily stated, where you can way more dramatically undermine Obamacare in a way that the average person will just perceive as assisting people that need it but giving them the power to choose, as opposed to Obama's way of doing it. And then I'll repeat for the last time, the employer mandate. You keep the employer mandate out of 34 states, which I think is going to pinch the administration.
I think it's exactly right. And it's also the nature of the case means that it lets you try that conservative approach in the states that most want it to succeed. Yeah. You're letting states choose whether this is what they want to try or whether they want to stick with Obamacare. So you're giving yourself the best shot you're going to get of showing the public that this can work before going into a presidential election. It would be pretty tough to ask for a better opportunity to try out conservative approaches to health policy than this.
And
that doesn't mean they'll take it, but I think it's an enormous opportunity if it works out this way.
And you could buy some time if you went like the SASA thing. Just we'll extend the subsidies for 6 months just because you're all victim of the IRS's bait and switch. And then it would allow you the time to form the consensus, put it on the president's desk, and buy you the time, I keep emphasizing, to get into the presidential election year when no major decision is going to be made because it'll be a jump ball for the candidate.
So I think it makes sense for Republicans to try this. A real off-ramp, it's very hard to imagine the president actually signing under any circumstances.
Even this one. Even you think he'll take the heat
as the exchanges
melt around?
It's hard to say, but
it
would be such a loss for him that it's hard to imagine. I do think Republicans need to try, and that by trying and suggesting to the public that he's standing in the way of them being able to do that in their states, they make real progress. But it may be that they end up pulling back a little from that and trying something else to see if he'll sign it. It's hard to predict the political dynamics.
I know I'm picking your brain here, but we've got the six-month patch. The media can't run the story about the people who need the money for their pre-existing condition. And then when they do, isn't our response, we absolutely want to help Mary Jane Smith, but the president is standing in the way.
Yeah.
I mean, it just creates a dynamic.
Which is,
we're trying to give money to the American people that he's stopping because of his bureaucratic preferences, and we can walk away, whereas he, I don't think, can. But
so you think he'd even refuse to sign the six-month patch?
No, not necessarily. I think Republicans, if it's decided for the plaintiffs and there's not a stay, Republicans that day should propose a six-month patch without the mandates, without the employer mandate. They should even try to get rid of the individual mandate and see what he says. I think that puts him in a very difficult place. It complicates all of the sob stories.
You think put the individual mandate on?
I think you got to try, and, if he vetoes it, you try again without it. There's no reason not to see what you can get and force a conversation about what he's willing to do and what they're willing to do.
Yeah, my only point.
An extension is Congress has the power to give the states time in a way that the president doesn't at least as easily have.
And I've never worked on the Hill, but my only point is we got to keep it simple, stupid, right? I mean, if you're hurting this.
Get rid of the mandates is pretty simple. That doesn't mean he signs it, but I think it puts Republicans in a decent place to start the argument about
it. I just think everybody needs to know well in advance what the strategy is.
Do you think the Republican House caucus can hold that together? I mean, there are 30 to 50 members who probably would only vote for the most extreme option there, right?
I don't know. I'm not sure that's the right way to read those 30 to 50 members. It's possible. And I think it's helpful that this conversation is happening now among them and among us and among everybody. But it depends on what they're hearing in their districts and what they're hearing in their states and what they're seeing in the country. But it seems to me that an opening move that is a patch without the mandates has got to be understood as an immediate partial victory. And it would be pretty hard for a Republican member to vote against that. Now, you never know and where the groups line up and where the members line up, but it's important to try. I mean, there's not enough of that happening in this Congress. And, I think that would make so much sense and would put the president in such a tough spot that it's worth a try.
Here's the pitch I'd make to people like that, which is at some point you're going to have to replace Obamacare. I won't repeat all of Yuval's very excellent points for why this is the best place to do it. The other point I made is, look, you're perfectly happy to draw a line in the sand and say never, ever will we help out Obama. But you're not the only players here. You're going to have a lot of Republicans in your state legislature and your governor who might well take the option out of your hands. So you might as well strike now when you can still control it without, and it will have a domino effect. Once some Republicans start going, then the grossest argument, but the one that they immediately respond to is, the NRCC has already done a study. The people who are most adversely affected by this, not surprisingly,
are in what they call R plus 10 districts, right? These are the reddest of the red states who were the most happy to say, no, we don't want anything to do with this. They're going to have to explain to their constituents and the governor's constituents, yeah, Nevada gets subsidies, but no, we don't, because we don't like Obamacare. Wouldn't it be much better to have something to say to them is, we're going to do it the right way this time. This will be our first simple step in getting there. And then when we win the presidency in 2016, we'll finish the job. Even for a conservative Republican, that's a very sellable, it seems to me, and principled message.
I just want to get clear on one simple part myself. You're taking the Irving Kristol's old line, that let people have control of their own money. Mm-hmm. Give them tax credits instead of let them buy the insurance they want. Americans are an enterprising people. Doctors are bringing back fee-for-service. Walmart is coming out. We'll have tell you what it costs for strep throat. I think we'll get a lot of that. And we'll probably want, people want to have policies not encumbered by supporting Viagra and everything else. Right. But you're saying we can't exactly do that under the current structure?
Well, look, under Obamacare, you can't do that.
No, but we
Obamacare defines insurance very strictly and very comprehensively. The first step in any Republican approach has to be to end that, the Title I regulation of insurance under Obamacare, and let the states have much broader definitions of health insurance, as many states, especially these particular states, did until last year. And you allow them to sell much more sort of catastrophic coverage, much more insurance-like health insurance, and it would be a lot cheaper.
Yuval, that's the thing, right? I mean, you, I'm sure, looked at this a lot more closely than I have. The product on these exchanges stinks, right? People, yeah, okay, right. The government's paying half of it. I can't tell you how many people are finding out for the first time what a $5,000 deductible means. Most people don't spend more than $5,000 a year on health care, and they're like, gee, this is terrific. I've got health insurance. I just spent $4,000 out of my own pocket for all my family's medical needs. I don't think there's a whole lot of happy consumers who are saying this is the greatest thing since sliced bread.
I think that's right. Now, high deductibles are certainly also part of catastrophic coverage.
Oh, I understand that.
The problem with Obamacare is that it's got an upside-down idea of what high deductible insurance looks like. So because the definition is so comprehensive, it requires insurance to cover very basic routine care, doctor's visits of a certain sort and this and that. And then if you have a real emergency and you're in the hospital, that's where your $5,000 deductible kicks in. Generally, catastrophic coverage works the other way. You pay for very routine care, for a doctor's visit that really only costs $15, though he'll charge your insured, you know, $75 if you let him. And it's when you face a catastrophic expense that your insurance kicks in. And so the first exposure that a lot of people are having to high deductible coverage is a kind of upside-down catastrophic coverage. And it leaves them wondering what the point is. Why are they paying for insurance if they're also paying for all of their health needs out of pocket?
This is like buying car insurance where they pay for your oil changes, but don't pay
for
hit by a bus.
Right.
It's just the craziest. Anyway.
Right, exactly.
Well, this has been really fine. But before we break and have reception, we have a number of people who know a lot about this. And I thought, before we break, I want to see if maybe Dr. Strauch has a comment or Kurt, whether you had any reflections, or Sandy Hecker. Dr. Schrauf?
This is a very, very complex discussion in terms of the so-called chaos that may erupt. And the way I kind of look at it, listening to you, I'm not a lawyer, is who are the most vulnerable providers in the system? And to me, that's the insurance companies. And they are locked into a system in which a deal was made. And if you read Stuart Brill's new book, Bitter Pill, in painstaking detail, he goes through every deal that was made.
Huh?
And the purpose of every deal that was made was, make me whole. I'll support if you make me whole. So that the drug industry wanted a continuation of no drugs from Canada. They wanted no comparative efficiency research. It was said to be a little project. It wasn't even funded as a little project. So the drug companies continued to sell the very most expensive of drugs when there are cheaper drugs that might be available. and they continued from Bush's era, no negotiation with Medicare on drugs. So they're happy, and they'll do fine no matter what happens here, because the majority of people that need something will be fine in getting the money across. The problem is the insurance companies, because to me, what's going to happen is a whole bunch of people are going to give up their insurance.
Right.
And when they give up their insurance, the insurance company, it seems to me, is going to say, well, we're not going to continue doing what we're doing. Right. Insurance companies have demonstrated over the years that they're capable of saying, we're no longer a health insurance company. We're now going to be a life insurance company. You know, they're not doing anything except taking money from a bunch of places and then giving it back to someone else. They really do the least creativity. So I think they're kind of the first to drop out.
And drop out of the exchanges entirely.
Yeah.
There's another look, important point there. I think that's exactly right. And it's important to remember also that the insurers are counting on a part of Obamacare that's called a risk corridor program, right, to survive the next couple of years, which basically allows them, if they end up with much higher risks and much higher costs than they anticipated, allows them to get an essentially open-ended taxpayer subsidy to make up for the difference, except that in the omnibus bill at the end of the year, the end of last year, the Republicans were able to get a provision into the bill that says that the Treasury can't spend money on the risk corridor program. They can only spend what they take in.
Oh, yeah.
If this case goes for the plaintiffs, the insurers would have needed the risk corridor program in a big way, because they will face very high unanticipated costs in a lot of states. If they think they can't get that money and they face these costs, and remember, the exchanges are not a huge part of their business. They don't have to become a life insurance company. There are about 10 million people in the exchanges nationwide. Maybe there'll be 12 million at the end of this year. In a country of 300 million people, where the insurers cover about 210 million people. These are national, you know, big nationwide insurance companies. Getting out of these markets rather than just taking a huge loss in some small piece of it that they're in right now because they think the federal government might take over the whole thing in the future and they want to be on the good side of HHS. If you're sitting in a board meeting at one of these insurers and you're looking at the numbers here, getting out of the exchanges is not a bad idea if it's chaos. It's a reason why there is some leverage that Republicans would have over the administration to avoid chaos. Chaos could cause them to lose the insurers, which they cannot afford to do. And as you say, it's all a kind of intricate system of how do you make people whole and how do you move money from here to there. Losing the subsidies would be a major blow to that system.
And then,
to me, the biggest problem is that we're back to where we were around 2010, 2011. And Uwe Reinhardt, the economist of Princeton, who talks about this a lot, writes about it, came up with a very simple concept that most people in this room, I'm sure, know, back in the early 80s, and it was as follows. Here is the percent of GDP that goes to healthcare, and back then it was around 4, 5, 6%. By 1990, it was about 9 or 10%. And he drew it on a curve, and he showed the curve inevitably going up, and eventually it reaches 100%. So people say, well, what are you talking about? And he says, well, what that means is 100% of money spent in the United States is on health care. So you laugh, just like people just laughed. And they say, okay, we can't do that. We have to have clothing. We have to have food. We have to have shelter. So we're not going to do that. So you say, okay, are you willing to do 50% for health care? He said, that's outrageous. I spoke the first time on the health care system in 1991. And at that point, it was something like 9 or 10%. And there was the projection, you know, going forward.
Yeah.
And I said, you think you could handle 30%? Of course not. 20%? No. 14, 15%, okay, because that's within sight. But we passed that 14 or 15%.
Right.
We're now about 18%. We've just had a couple of years of flat, and I can assure you it's going up. And 2014 is... early data is in from some places indicating about a 5% rise, well above GDP, and the big hit is going to come in the next 2 years, showing that curve is back in play. So out of this all, There is no simple solution.
And then will come price controls.
Well,
but that's the argument for not ending up where we started, right? For trying to use this as an opportunity to push a kind of health reform that would actually allow costs to be controlled. The core of the healthcare debate between left and right has always been about how do you control costs? Do you put Princeton economists in charge of deciding what prices should be? Or do you let consumers decide what's valuable and what's not? And, you know, that's still the basic difference. And it does seem to me that using this case as an opportunity, if it goes for the plaintiffs, to move in the direction of a system that would be better at controlling costs by letting consumers make decisions, is the least we ought to do. It's just not clear that people are going to want to be that ambitious about it.
The Princeton economist is now starting to talk about what is something talked about a lot in England and used, and that's called qualies.
Yeah, quality-adjusted life years.
And
how much are you worth when you're 68?
That doesn't play very well in the United States, for sure. The problem is you have all of these players in the system, and all of them are for-profit companies, with the exception of hospitals that say, many of them say they're not for-profit, but looks to me like they are for-profit in terms of how they run and how they fold.
They're non-profit like the NFL, isn't it?
Right.
Yes. Well, that's very good. I just want to make a quick check. Kurt or Sandy, anything you like?
A quick comment and then a question for y'all. I mean, you've convinced me the Republicans are working on alternatives and that they'll probably have them ready by June 29th. But I guess my concern is that they not only be ready, but that they be pre-sold. Otherwise, come June 30th, we're left with that do it Obama's way, or you'll never kiss your wife again, or you have dying of cancer and it's a pre-existing condition, you won't get insurance. It's a battle, it seems to me, we're going to lose. So I just hope that they not just develop it, but pre-sell it. My question for you all is there anything Obama can do with an executive order to get around the court's ruling if it goes against him? Now, I know that sounds like it's, you
very
know,
quaint.
Unimaginably audacious, but he's been getting more audacious with this executive overreach. So can you think of a nightmare scenario, at least, in which Obama tries something like that?
Well, my answer is it would be completely lawless and unprecedented, so
right.
I put it
so
in
yes.
a coin toss, yeah.
right.
Look, the truth is, if the states are willing to play, he might have some play in the joints, notwithstanding what I just discussed, right? But we are talking about, once you get past the Illinois of the world, who I think are probably going to just flip voluntarily, it's a little tough for the chief executive of the federal government to tell states that they have now established the exchanges when the states are saying, no, we haven't. And the statute's very specific about what states need to do in a state-run exchange. So I've discounted these scare stories that he can do it. There are these partnership exchanges where he could create the facade of them working. More realistically, I think what you might see is Virginia just went through a huge debate about whether to take Medicaid funding, right? So he said, Terry McAuliffe says, I will establish my exchange. The state legislature says no, and HHS treats McAuliffe as the spokesman for Virginia. But at the end of the day, he's still nibbling around the edges. He's still not really getting back where he wants to do, and I don't buy the doomsday scenario that he's going to. I will point out that we've worried about this. Senators Hatch and others asked Burwell directly, and she wrote a letter saying there is no plan B, we will not do anything.
The fact that
she committed perjury doesn't slow them down, but still, it would be a little odd if they came out with this game plan on June 30th after assuring everybody that there was nothing they could do in the wake of this decision.
Well, I would say pre-selling is probably too much to hope for. Really, Congress being ready for something like this is probably too much to hope for. I think there will be a lot of work having been done, and it's not just about this Congress. Congress has never been particularly good at getting itself organized, any Congress. I think there's been a lot more work done in the last few months than I would have imagined, and there will be bills that could be proposed, but is it just going to be orderly and everybody knows what to do? That's not going to happen.
Ryan made an interesting point, which I hadn't really thought of. If you pass it before June 29th, it gets scored much better than if it comes after. Follow, because right now CBO has scored it as 50 states get the subsidies. You come back with a bill that has, if the decision comes down, and then they will rescore it to say, no, really only 13 states or 17 states, depending on how you count, get the subsidies, then that'll be a dramatic drop in federal expenditures. If you come back with something that says we will get back to the old number, then you have to come up with the new revenue to do it. I know I made that too confusing. If on day one you're spending $10 billion and you come in with a bill that says we'll spend $10 billion on day two, that, in CBO speak, will be an increase because the first $10 billion they have brought down to $3 billion.
Now, that's also true for this idea that the president's going to wave around a one-page fix-it bill. He's got to pay for that, too.
That's the other point. And that long-winded explanation was just a way of saying that the normal lethargy and inertia on the Hill might be overcome by the fact that you can go to reluctant members and say, if we pass it before the opinion, you don't have to have a fight about raising taxes or cutting other stuff, whereas if we pass it afterwards, you will.
Well, as to take a line from Marty Diamond, this is too complicated for my simple Jewish mind to comprehend. we're trying to get out of this. We're hoping to get a conversation among friends, and I think that's what we've done. So I want to thank Mike, Ed, Yuval, Kerry for coming along with this. And we have wine to serve people. Well, thank our panel for this.
Oh, yes, they might. I think some more over here. I said it.
I said it.
Yeah.
Did I ever tell you my George Will story? No. So he calls me because I'm doing this other cast. Oh, thanks. That was good. And I said, oh, George, it's 9-0.
Good to see you again. We met.